A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a good one. He points out we've spent a lot of episodes on how broken Israeli rental law is for tenants, and he's right. Tenancy at will is the default. People can be tossed out on 30 days' notice. There's no real stability. But he says if we're going to have a fair conversation about reform, we need to look at the other side. What do landlords actually fear? What would a landlord lobby demand in exchange for accepting tenant protections? And if we were rewriting the law tomorrow, how do we build something that works for both sides?
This is the conversation nobody's having. The public debate in Israel is basically tenants versus landlords, zero sum, pick your team. But the reality is the current system is broken for both sides, just broken in different ways.
The tenant has almost no rights. But flip the coin, and the landlord has almost no protections either. I think that's the starting point most people miss.
We've done episodes on tenant suffering, and that suffering is real. The system is genuinely unjust for renters. But today we're playing devil's advocate for the landlord. Not to defend anyone, but because you can't design a reform that actually passes without understanding what the other side is terrified of losing.
If you don't address those fears, you get what we have now. Stalemate. No reform, no protections for anyone, just the status quo grinding on forever while rents climb and nobody feels secure.
Let's start by understanding what the landlord actually faces in the current system, because it's not what most people assume.
When I hear Israeli landlord, I think of some guy in Herzliya with three apartments and a BMW. But that's not the typical landlord here.
No, and this is one of the biggest misconceptions. A huge portion of Israeli landlords are middle-class families with one rental unit. Maybe they inherited a parent's apartment. Maybe they bought a small place as a pension investment. They've got a mortgage on that property. They're relying on the rental income to cover it. And one bad tenant can wreck them financially.
Walk me through the nightmare scenario. I'm a landlord. I've got one rental unit. I've got a mortgage. Tenant stops paying.
You're in trouble immediately. You still owe the bank every month, let's say 5 or 6,000 shekels. You still owe Arnona, the municipal tax. The tenant's in your property, not paying you a shekel, and you can't just change the locks. That's illegal. You have to go through the Enforcement and Collection Authority, Hotzah Lapo'al.
Which takes how long?
3 to 6 months, minimum. And that's if everything goes smoothly. During those months, the tenant is living in your property for free, your bleeding mortgage payments, and the tenant can also rack up utility debts. If those are in your name or tied to the property, you're on the hook.
You're paying their bills too.
And there's a case from Ramat Gan that made the rounds. A landlord waited 7 months to evict a non-paying tenant. The tenant left owing 45,000 shekels in unpaid rent and another 12,000 in damages. The landlord never recovered most of it.
45,000 shekels. That's not an abstraction. That's someone's entire savings.
That's the point. For a family with one rental unit, that kind of loss isn't a business expense. It's a catastrophe. They might not be able to pay their own mortgage now. The system doesn't protect them either.
The landlords have all the power. Narrative only works if you're talking about large corporate landlords. The small landlord with one unit is actually incredibly exposed.
That exposure creates a chilling effect. When landlords feel the system won't protect them from bad actors, they either exit the rental market entirely, sell the unit, convert it to short-term Airbnb, or they raise rents to build in what's essentially a risk premium.
Which reduces rental stock and drives up prices for everyone.
The Times of Israel reported that rental prices in Tel Aviv rose 8.4% year over year in 2025, and analysts partly attributed that to landlords' pricing and regulatory risk and reduced supply. Every time a landlord hears a horror story about a 7-month eviction, they add a little more padding to the rent they charge the next tenant.
Even good tenants pay for bad tenants. The risk gets socialized across everyone who rents.
That's the perverse outcome of a system that protects nobody properly. It's not that Israeli law is too pro-tenant or too pro-landlord. It's that the law is basically absent. tenancy at will is the default. There's no minimum lease term, no rent control, no just cause eviction protections, but also no fast eviction for non-payment. It's the worst of both worlds.
It's a legal vacuum with a 30-day notice period slapped on top.
That's exactly what it is. And in that vacuum, the worst actors on both sides thrive. Tenants who know the system can exploit it, and landlords who know the system can exploit it. Everyone else just gets ground down.
Let's talk about the tenant who knows the system. Daniel mentioned this in his prompt, the fear landlords have of tenants who treat eviction law as a shield. What does that actually look like?
The professional tenant problem. These are tenants who understand exactly how slow the system is and use it strategically. They stop paying rent, and when the landlord files for eviction, they file counter-complaints, maintenance issues, harassment claims, anything that creates a factual dispute. Every dispute delays the process.
Because the enforcement authority isn't equipped to adjudicate factual disputes quickly.
Hotza'a Lapel Al is designed for straightforward debt collection, not for resolving, he said, she said, about whether the boiler was actually broken. So the case bounces between the enforcement authority and the courts, and months go by.
During those months, the tenant's living rent-free.
Often damaging the property on the way out, knowing they'll never be held accountable. Or they file a small claims case for their deposit back, claiming the landlord withheld it illegally. And the landlord has to prove damages in a system that's slow and unpredictable.
The landlord not only loses the rent, they potentially lose the deposit too, even if the tenant trashed the place.
This is where the German comparison gets interesting. Because Germany has some of the strongest tenant protections in Europe, minimum lease terms of 3 to 5 years, just cause eviction, rent indexing through the Mietspiegel system. But here's what people miss. Germany also gives landlords extremely reliable remedies. If a tenant in Germany misses 2 consecutive months of rent, the landlord can get an expedited eviction order within 2 to 3 weeks. Not months, weeks. The law says, we will protect tenants from arbitrary eviction, but we will not protect tenants who don't pay. That's the trade.
The German model isn't tenants win, landlords lose. It's both sides get something real, and both sides have clear obligations.
The tenant gets stability. You can't be evicted just because the landlord decided to sell or because your lease happened to end. But the landlord gets certainty. If you don't pay, you're out, fast. That's the package deal.
In Israel, we have neither. The tenant has no stability and the landlord has no certainty.
Which is why the conversation about reform has to start with acknowledging that both sides are losing under the current system. You can't just say, let's add tenant protections, without also saying, and here's how we'll make sure landlords aren't left holding the bag when things go wrong.
Because if you only add tenant protections, the landlord lobby will kill the bill. And honestly, they'd have a point.
Imagine you're a small landlord with one unit. Someone proposes a law that says you can't evict a tenant except for specific causes, and the lease automatically renews, and rent increases are capped. Your first thought isn't, this is fair. Your first thought is, what happens if I get a tenant who doesn't pay and I can't get rid of them?
You'd fight that law with everything you've got.
You'd win because the landlord lobby in Israel is organized and politically connected. So the status quo persists, and tenants keep getting 30-day notices, and nothing changes.
The smart strategy, and this is really what Daniel's getting at, is to offer landlords something they desperately want in exchange for something tenants desperately need.
That's the whole game. And what landlords want, more than anything, is speed. Fast eviction for non-payment. A clear, reliable path to getting their property back when a tenant breaches the contract. If you give them that, they might actually accept minimum lease terms and rent stabilization.
Because right now, the only leverage a landlord has is the 30-day notice. It's the one tool in the toolbox. You can't take that away without replacing it with something else.
The 30-day notice is a terrible tool. It's a sledgehammer. It lets bad landlords evict good tenants for no reason, but it also lets good landlords escape bad tenants, barely. 6 months of non-payment versus 30 days notice isn't actually a solution for the landlord either.
We're not defending the current system. We're saying it fails everyone, just in different ways, and the path to reform runs through addressing both sets of failures simultaneously.
That's it. And I think the most productive way to approach this is to look at models that actually work elsewhere, Germany, France, and ask, what did they give landlords to get tenant protections through?
because those countries didn't get stable rental markets by accident. They built them through deliberate compromise.
That's what we want to sketch out today. Not a tenant wish list, not a landlord wish list, a package deal that could actually pass and actually work.
To really get this, we need to walk through the specific nightmare scenarios that keep landlords up at night. The non-payment spiral, the professional tenant, the damage and disappear. Because until you understand what they're afraid of, you can't design a system that addresses those fears.
Then we build the framework. What would a balanced lease law actually look like? What's the German Mietspiegel? And how would an Israeli version work? What about deposit escrow and fast-track eviction and landlord insurance pools?
The goal isn't to make anyone perfectly happy. It's to make everyone slightly unhappy in equal measure, which is usually the sign of a good compromise.
The best law is one that both sides hate a little bit.
All right, let's get into the weeds. Walk me through what actually happens when a tenant stops paying, the full timeline, from the first mispayment to the moment the landlord finally gets the property back.
Month 1, tenant misses rent. You call, you text, maybe they have a story, you give them a week. Month 2 hits, still nothing. Now you're 2 months down, 10 or 12,000 shekels in the hole, and you haven't even started the legal process because you were being reasonable.
Being reasonable costs you.
So you file with Hotza'a Lapoel. But here's where it gets ugly. The tenant gets notified and they have time to respond. If they respond with any kind of dispute, the apartment has mold, the landlord never fixed the air conditioning. Suddenly, it's not a simple debt collection anymore.
Even if the mold complaint is completely fabricated.
Doesn't matter. The enforcement authority isn't a court. They can't adjudicate factual disputes. So the case gets kicked to the regular court system, and now you're looking at months more. Meanwhile, the tenant's still there, still not paying.
You're still paying the mortgage, the arnona, maybe the va'ad bayit.
All of it. And if the utilities are in your name, common for older buildings, the tenant can run up thousands in water and electricity that you're legally responsible for. The utility companies come after the name on the account, not the person living there.
The landlord's exposure isn't just the lost rent. It's the mortgage, the taxes, the building fees, the utilities, and eventually the legal fees. It's a cascade.
The cascade doesn't stop when the tenant finally leaves, because often they leave damage. Holes in walls, broken fixtures, appliances removed. I heard about a case in Haifa where a tenant ripped out the kitchen cabinets and sold them before disappearing.
Sold the cabinets.
Sold the cabinets. And the landlord's recourse? Small claims court. Another 6 months, another filing fee, and even if you win, collecting the judgment from someone who's vanished or has no assets is a whole separate nightmare.
The 7-month Ramat Gan case we mentioned, that's not an outlier. That's just what happens when everything goes wrong in sequence.
This is what shapes landlord behavior. Every landlord knows someone who knows someone this happened to. So they screen tenants obsessively. They demand guarantors, post-dated checks, huge deposits, sometimes illegally large deposits. They gravitate toward foreign tenants or students whose parents are backing them because those tenants have something to lose.
Which means the tenants who need housing most, young Israelis without family money, new immigrants without local guarantors, they get screened out.
The system's dysfunction doesn't just hurt the landlord who gets a bad tenant. It creates a filtering effect that pushes the most vulnerable renters to the margins. They end up in the worst units with the most desperate landlords, which is a recipe for exploitation on both sides.
The landlord's fear isn't irrational. It's based on real exposure, and that fear distorts the whole market.
Which brings us back to the German comparison. Because Germany looked at this exact dynamic and said, we need to give landlords confidence that the system will protect them from genuine bad actors, so they'll accept the obligations we're placing on them.
The Mietspiegel. The rent mirror. Explain how that actually works.
It's a public database of comparable rents, updated every 2 years based on actual lease data from the local market. It factors in location, size, age, amenities, condition. A landlord can charge up to 10% above the Mietspiegel for a new tenant, but during the tenancy, increases are tied to the consumer price index.
It's not a hard rent cap. It's a benchmark that prevents gouging, but allows market adjustment.
And landlords accept it because they also get the stability of long leases, 3 to 5 years minimum, and the certainty that if a tenant stops paying, they're out in 2 or 3 weeks. It's a trade. predictable income in exchange for predictable rent.
The key word there is predictable. Both sides can plan. The tenant knows they won't be evicted on a whim or priced out overnight. The landlord knows the rent will track inflation and the mortgage will get paid.
Compare that to Israel, where a landlord can raise the rent by 30% at lease renewal just because they feel like it, and the tenant can either pay or leave in 30 days. That's not a market. That's a hostage situation that repeats every year.
The landlord who does that isn't necessarily greedy. They might be terrified that if they don't max out the rent now, they won't be able to cover their costs if something goes wrong later. The risk premium gets built into every decision.
The current system produces exactly the behavior that tenants hate. Arbitrary evictions, unpredictable rent hikes, demands for massive deposits, but it produces that behavior because landlords are operating in a legal vacuum with no safety net.
All right. So if the current system is broken for both sides, what would a better system actually look like? Let's design it.
There are three pillars that any serious reform has to address. First, minimum lease terms with just cause eviction. Second, a fast-track process for non-payment. Third, something to handle deposits and damages that doesn't require a year in court.
The third one is where a lot of the daily friction lives. Two people arguing about whether that scratch on the floor was there before, whether the paint counts as normal wear. Those disputes are small in money but enormous in time and aggravation.
They're perfectly designed to make everyone feel cheated. The tenant thinks the landlord is inventing damages to steal the deposit. The landlord thinks the tenant is using the slow court system as leverage to get the full deposit back regardless of what they did.
What's the fix?
Mandatory third-party escrow for deposits. The money never sits in the landlord's bank account. It goes into a neutral account, and at the end of the lease, both sides have to agree on deductions. If they don't agree, it goes to binding arbitration, not court.
Binding arbitration, meaning a neutral third party, looks at the evidence and makes a decision, and both sides are stuck with it.
And you cap the deposit at 2 months' rent, which is already common here, but you make the arbitration fast. 30 days, decision is final. Landlord gets a clear path to compensation for real damage. Tenant gets their money back quickly if they've been responsible.
That alone would eliminate a huge number of small claims court cases. But it only works if the arbitration is actually neutral. Who runs it?
That's the implementation question. Could be a government agency, could be a licensed private system like some U.S. states use. The key is that it's not the landlord's friend, not the tenant's uncle. It's a professional who looks at photos, receipts, move-in checklists, and makes a call.
Which forces both sides to document everything at the start of the lease, which is good practice anyway.
And that connects to the second piece, the landlord insurance pool. This is where the French model gets interesting. France has something called the Garantie des Loyers, a government-backed insurance fund that covers up to 36 months of unpaid rent.
36 months is generous.
It's extremely generous, and it's funded by a small tax on rental income. The idea is that landlords get paid even during eviction proceedings, so they're not financially destroyed by a non-paying tenant. That removes the desperation from the system.
Because right now, a landlord facing non-payment is panicking. Every month that goes by is real money they might never recover. If the insurance is covering those months, they can be patient. They can follow the process properly. They're not tempted to do something stupid like cut off the water.
That's the hidden benefit. When landlords have a safety net, they behave better. They're not screening tenants with paranoid intensity. They're not demanding your firstborn as a guarantor. They can afford to take a chance on someone with a thinner credit history.
The insurance pool isn't just landlord welfare. It actually opens up the rental market for tenants who currently get filtered out.
And you fund it through a tiny premium, 0.5% of rent, something like that. On a 5,000 shekel apartment, that's 25 shekels a month. The landlord pays it. The tenant benefits from a landlord who's not terrified of them.
The landlord benefits from knowing that even the worst-case scenario won't bankrupt them. That's worth 25 shekels a month.
Now combine this with the fast-track eviction for non-payment, and you've got a coherent package. The landlord accepts minimum 2-year leases and just-cause eviction rules. In exchange, they get, if the tenant doesn't pay, they're out in 30 to 45 days, and the insurance covers the lost rent in the meantime.
That's a real trade. Both sides are giving up something and getting something. The tenant gives up the ability to squat for 6 months without paying. The landlord gives up the ability to evict on a whim or jack up the rent arbitrarily.
The rent stabilization piece ties it together. You don't need German-style strict rent control, which can freeze the market if it's too rigid. What you do is a rent growth cap tied to the consumer price index plus 2%, with the ability to reset to market when the unit becomes vacant.
Sitting tenants get predictability. Their rent can't jump 20% because the neighborhood got trendy. But when they move out, the landlord can reprice to whatever the market will bear for the next tenant.
Which preserves the incentive to maintain and improve the property. If you couldn't ever reset the rent, landlords would let buildings deteriorate because there's no return on investment. The vacancy reset solves that.
The CPI plus 2%? That's not nothing. In a normal inflation environment, that's maybe 3 or 4% a year. The landlord's real income keeps pace. The tenant's rent doesn't outrun their salary.
Compare that to the current system where a landlord can say pay 30% more or get out in 30 days. That's not a negotiation, it's an ultimatum, and tenants accept it because moving costs even more.
The framework we're sketching is minimum 2-year lease with automatic renewal unless 6 months notice is given, just cause eviction only, fast track 30 to 45 day, eviction for non-payment, CPI plus 2% rent growth cap with vacancy reset, mandatory deposit escrow with binding arbitration, and a landlord insurance pool funded by a small premium.
That's it. And I think the political genius of this package is that each side gets to claim victory on the thing they care about most. Tenant advocates get stability and predictability. The landlord lobby gets speed and insurance against loss.
The question is whether either side would actually accept it. Because the tenant advocacy groups would look at the fast-track eviction and say, this is too harsh, what about tenants who fall on hard times? And the landlord lobby would look at just-cause eviction and say, you're taking away my property rights.
That's the test of a good compromise. If both sides are uncomfortable, you're probably in the right place. The alternative is what we have now, a system where tenants can be evicted for no reason in 30 days and landlords can be exploited for 6 months with no recourse. That's worse for everyone.
The perfect shouldn't be the enemy of the massively better.
There's a political reality here that Daniel alluded to in his prompt. No reform passes without landlord lobby buy-in. They're organized, they're connected, and they'll kill anything that feels like a pure tenant power grab. So the smart strategy is to give them something they need. Fast eviction for genuine bad actors, in exchange for the stability tenants need.
It's a package deal or it's nothing. And nothing is what we've had for decades.
The French guarantee des loyers is worth unpacking a bit more, because it solves a problem we haven't fully named. The problem isn't just that eviction is slow, it's that the landlord is financially bleeding the entire time the process drags on. The insurance decouples those two things.
Even if the eviction takes 45 days instead of 2 weeks, the landlord isn't panicking. The mortgage is still getting paid.
And that changes the psychology. A landlord who's not terrified is a landlord who doesn't demand 6 months of post-dated checks up front, who doesn't ask for your parents' 2.zehut, who doesn't treat every prospective tenant like a potential criminal.
The insurance premium, 0.5% of rent, who actually collects that? Is it tacked onto the owner bill?
The French model funds it through a small tax on rental income, collected nationally. In Israel, you'd probably attach it to the existing reporting system. Landlords already have to declare rental income to Mas Hakhnasa. You add a line item. 0.5% of monthly rent goes into the insurance pool. It's practically invisible.
The pool covers unpaid rent and damages beyond the deposit?
Up to a cap. The French version covers 36 months of unpaid rent, which is probably overkill for Israel. I'd say 18 months is a reasonable ceiling. Long enough to cover the worst-case eviction timeline plus repairs. Not so generous that it creates moral hazard.
Moral hazard being, if the insurance is too generous, landlords stop caring whether the tenant can actually pay.
You still want landlords to do basic screening. The insurance is a backstop, not a replacement for judgment. And you could structure it so the premium goes up if a landlord files too many claims. Incentivize them to be selective without punishing them for one bad experience.
That's elegant. It nudges behavior without mandating it. Which brings us to the political question Daniel raised. What does the landlord lobby actually demand, and can we give it to them without gutting tenant protections?
I think the landlord lobby's demands boil down to three things. 1. Speed. They want a non-paying tenant out fast, no loopholes, no endless delays. 2. Compensation. They want to be made whole for actual losses, not just get the property back. 3. Control. They want the right to reclaim the unit if they or their children need to live in it.
That third one is interesting. Owner move-in eviction. That's a standard just cause category in Germany. But it's also the loophole landlords abuse. They claim they're moving in, evict the tenant, then re-rent at a higher price.
Which is why you build in teeth. If a landlord evicts for owner move-in and then re-rents within, say, 12 months, the original tenant has a statutory claim for damages, moving costs, the rent differential, maybe a penalty. Make the fake move in too expensive to be worth it.
You require proof. The landlord has to show they actually moved in. Change of address, registration, utility bills, and their name. Something verifiable.
The German system requires the landlord or a close family member to occupy the unit. It's not a theoretical right, it's an actual move. And courts there do check.
The landlord lobby gets their three things. Speed, compensation, control. But each one comes with guardrails that prevent abuse. Fast eviction only for genuine non-payment. Compensation through insurance and escrow, not through squeezing tenants. Owner move-in, only if it's real.
What tenants get in return is the thing they've never had in Israel, the ability to say, this is my home, and I will be here next year, and the year after that, unless I stop paying or trash the place.
That's not a radical demand. That's the baseline in most developed countries.
It's the baseline, and we've normalized its absence here. Israelis talk about renting like it's a temporary condition you endure until you buy. But with home prices where they are, more and more people are going to be renting for decades, maybe permanently. The law needs to reflect that reality.
The law needs to make renting feel like a legitimate long-term arrangement, not a series of one-year hostage negotiations.
Which is why the minimum two-year lease with automatic renewal matters so much. It changes the default. Right now, the default is the lease ends and you leave unless the landlord agrees otherwise. Flip it to the lease renews unless someone gives 6 months' notice with a valid reason. That's a completely different power dynamic.
6 months is a lot of notice. That's intentional?
It gives the tenant time to find something else, and it gives the landlord time to line up the next tenant. It also discourages impulsive evictions. If you have to plan 6 months ahead to reclaim your property, you're only going to do it when you mean it.
The valid reasons are the just cause list. Non-payment, breach, owner move, in, major renovation that can't be done with the tenant in place.
That last one is important. If the building needs structural work, the landlord should be able to do it. But again, with guardrails, you have to show permits, you have to offer the tenant right of first refusal when the work is done, at the same rent plus the CPI adjustment.
The tenant isn't permanently displaced by a renovation that magically turns into a luxury upgrade with double the rent.
And these details matter because they're where trust gets built or destroyed. A law that just says major renovation is grounds for eviction without defining what happens after is a law that invites abuse. A law that specifies the tenant with first crack at returning at the stabilized rent is a law that aligns incentives.
The landlord gets to maintain the property. The tenant gets to come back. Both sides win if the renovation was genuine.
If it wasn't genuine, if it was a pretext to evict and reprice, the tenant has a legal claim. That's the kind of symmetry that makes a system durable. The framework is there. The question is, what anyone listening actually does with it. And I think there are practical steps on both sides of the lease agreement that don't require waiting for the Knesset to act.
Because the Knesset could be waiting a while.
It could be waiting forever. So if you're a tenant right now, don't rely on the default law. The default law is tenancy at will, and tenancy at will gives you almost nothing. Push for a lease that includes mutual notice periods, 60 or 90 days, not just 30, and a clear damage clause with a move-in checklist attached.
The move-in checklist is the thing nobody does and everyone wishes they had.
Email them to the landlord so there's a timestamp. If you end up in a deposit dispute, that's the difference between getting your money back and losing it.
If you're a landlord,
consider requiring a landlord insurance rider. There are private policies available in Israel now. They're not the government-backed pool we described, but they cover non-payment and major damage. Build the premium into your rental calculation. and use an escrow service for the deposit. Several Israeli law firms offer this now for a nominal fee.
Both sides can protect themselves partially, even in the current vacuum. But the real fix is legislative, and that brings us to the political reality Daniel was pointing at.
No reform passes without the landlord lobby. That's not cynicism, that's arithmetic. They have the organization, the access, and the votes. So the smart play isn't to fight them, it's to offer them a deal where they win something concrete.
Fast eviction for non-payment is the thing they want most. Give them 30 to 45 days, no loopholes, and suddenly they're listening.
In exchange, tenants get minimum lease terms, just cause eviction, and rent growth caps. That's the trade. Both sides walk away with something they didn't have before.
Which means if you care about this, and you should, because whether you rent or own, the stability of the rental market affects housing costs for everyone. Write to your MK. Don't send a vague complaint about rent prices. Send a specific proposal. Cite the German Mietspiegel. Cite the French Garantie des Loyers, and make the case for a balanced lease law that gives both sides something real.
The framework exists. Other countries have built it. We don't need to invent anything. We need to adapt what's already proven.
Here's the thing I keep coming back to. Even if we build this perfect balanced framework, would it actually increase rental supply? Or would landlords still exit the market for other reasons? Taxes, bureaucracy, better returns elsewhere?
That's the open question, and I don't think anyone has a clean answer. The optimistic case is that certainty brings more small landlords in. If you know the rules and they're stable, you can treat a rental unit like a predictable investment rather than a gamble. The pessimistic case is that Israel's property taxes and regulatory overhead make renting out a single unit unattractive, no matter what the lease law says.
There's a version where the reform works but takes 5 years to change behavior because landlords have long memories. They've been burned, or they know someone who's been burned, and they don't trust the new system until they see it working.
Which is why the first few years of any reform are critical. If the fast-track eviction actually delivers in 45 days, if the insurance pool actually pays out, the story starts circulating. Hey, the new system actually works. That's what shifts sentiment. But if the implementation is botched, if the arbitration is slow, if the insurance claims get denied on technicalities, the whole thing collapses and we're back to square one.
The law is only half the battle. The other half is building the institutions that make the law real.
That's the part Israel struggles with. We're good at passing ambitious laws and terrible at staffing the enforcement bodies that give them teeth.
There's a bigger reason to get this right that goes beyond landlord-tenant fairness. Daniel mentioned it in his prompt, the societal erosion. When people can't put down roots, when they're moving every year or two because the lease got terminated or the rent spiked, you don't have neighborhoods anymore. You have dormitories.
That's not just a quality of life issue. As home ownership becomes less attainable, and it is, the price-to-income ratio in Israel keeps widening. More people are going to be long-term renters by necessity, not by choice. If the rental market remains unstable, you're building a society where a huge chunk of the population has no stake in their community.
That's a national security problem, dressed up as a housing policy problem. Social stability depends on people feeling like they belong somewhere. If your address changes every 12 months, you don't join the Va'ad Bayit, you don't know your neighbors, you don't care what happens to the local school.
That atomization has political consequences. People who feel rootless are more susceptible to resentment, more likely to check out of civic life entirely. You can't build a cohesive society on a foundation of annual lease renewals.
The reform we're talking about isn't just a consumer protection issue. It's about whether Israel functions as a society in 20 years.
Which is why it's worth fighting for, and why the compromise framework matters. The best law is one that both sides hate a little bit. If tenants think it's too landlord-friendly, and landlords think it's too tenant-friendly, you've probably found the balance.
Right now, nobody's happy, which means we're not at the balance point. We're just in a void. The goal is to climb out of the void into something that works.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In antiquity, Greek geographers believed the Aleutian Islands concealed a vast subglacial lake fed by meltwater from a mythical northern ice sheet that explained the region's perpetual fog and unusually mild ocean currents. The theory persisted for centuries before anyone actually sailed there.
A lake that fogged an ocean. Solid reasoning. Wrong continent.
This has been My Weird Prompts. produced by the inimitable Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, do us a favor and leave a review wherever you listen. It helps people find the show.
We're at myweirdprompts.com. New episodes every week. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.